until he stands naked and trembling before them. His body is a mess of scars that seem to whiten as his skin pinkens in the cold. He would cross his arms if he could, but as is, he can only clutch his middle one-handed. Sasa studies his body and says, "You look like you've been chewed up and spit out."
"Pretty much."
"Here's how this will work. I'm going to give you a head start of 30 seconds.
"Fuck you."
"And then I'm going to come after you."
"Even if I outrun you, I'll freeze."
"You look like you're accustomed to surviving." She makes a shooing motion with her hands. "One," she says. "Two, three, four, five." And before she can count six, he has leapt off the stage, knocked aside tables, padding away. Sasa continues to count aloud in a calm voice that matches her movements as she steps off the stage and retrieves her bow and quiver and walks down the corridor that leads to the entry. The women follow her into the half-light of day. The air is bracingly cold, the clouds boil, the horizon burns. An ice storm has coated everything so that it appears as slick as glass. In the distance, almost halfway across the vast open parking lot, Coulter races away from them. He keeps his steps short and his good arm outstretched for balance. He falls twice, but does not pause, scrambling up to bolt forward again. His buttocks redden, his breath chimneys from his mouth. She hears a few of her girls say, "Don't," and "Let him go, Sasa." But she doesn't listen. She has to be strong for all of them. She has to expel the hurt stored inside her. She pinches an arrow from her quiver and notches it into the string and lifts it to her eye and says, 30. Simon and Ella expect a visit from Danica, but she doesn't come for several days, and when she does, she is limping. She has a fat lip, and one of her eyes is plum purple, swollen so badly, revealing only a weepy slit. She tries to mask it with makeup, and she tries to walk without wincing. She comes through the side door into the kitchen, and Simon pulls out a chair for her at the table, and she settles into it with a sigh. She wears a foul, rotten cloak so as not to be recognized, and he helps her out of it and hangs it on a hook and asks her if she needs anything, and she says no. When he remains beside her, hovering, leaning into her as if she were a flower, she waves him away. Ella can't help but feel instantly annoyed, annoyed by Simon, the way he behaves around her like a cowed pet, and annoyed by Danica, not for anything she has said or done, just for existing. She cannot help it. She has always found pretty women, the kind who seem to waste time in front of the mirror, who seem to serve no purpose outside of lounging and preening, to be trifling, pathetic, even foul, like dead songbirds with maggots nesting inside their bright breasts. But when Danica rubs her knee, in obvious pain, Ella grudgingly allows her annoyance to give way to concern and asks, "What happened?"
"He's angry. That's what happened."
"I'm sorry."
"I'm not. I'm glad he's angry. He's angry because he's worried."
Her hand rises from her knee to her thigh, where she keeps her dagger beneath her dress. She fingers it, and her mouth twitches with a smile. She says she knows what they're wondering. They're wondering, if she hates her husband so much, why not poison him? That is the woman's way, isn't it? Poison? She has considered it. Of course she has considered it. These days he has grown more and more paranoid, and before he would sip his wine, before he would knife into a steak, he made his chef, or server, or sometimes even Danica, taste everything. Every S she utters takes a little too long to get out of her mouth, so that her sentences sound like a spitting fuse. Ella can't tell if it's the swollen lip or some pain-relieving opiate that causes this. Besides, Danica says, poisoning him, killing him, would accomplish little beyond her temporary satisfaction. She might get away with it, or she might get caught. And then someone else would take his place of power and similarly abuse it. Ella cannot help but wonder about her, cannot help but feel this woman is more than she appears. There is something far more substantial and dangerous about her. She is like the blade she carries. A blade is rigid and cold and sharp. A blade is a decoration. A
A blade is a tool. A blade is a threat.
In a cold voice, carefully enunciating each word, Danica tells them her reason for coming now. She has a plan, and the plan concerns them, and the plan could kill them if they aren't careful. But if it works, and it just might, then an uprising will come that the deputies will not be able to quell.
Go ahead, then. What is it?
My dear husband, she says, has decided to throw a ball.
Who's he going to throw it at?
Simon says.
Ella says, she means a party, you idiot.
A party, Danica says. A costume party, no less, with cheeses and meats and sweet liquors and desserts and everything else one might consider far too extravagant for these thin times. And he plans to invite everyone who matters, who has any influence. Just as he believes in terrorizing those who defy him, he believes in spoiling those who would support him. She brings a hand to the corner of her swelled eye. If there was a time for us to do something, it would be then. Wouldn't you agree? The first arrow misses, sailing to the left of Coulter and embedding itself in the ice. The second arrow, too, skitters past him. The third arrow might have struck its mark, if not for Clark. The crowd of girls did not notice her when they charged out of the mall, nor did they notice the gone guard, no longer at her post. They were too intent on the naked figure sliding jerkily across the ice-scalloped parking lot. So when the woman named Sasa falls forward with an arrow nested in the back of her skull, when they spin around to see Clark standing there with another arrow notched, they can only stare dumbly. They are pale and thin and quivering and bent-backed, no longer a mob, just a bunch of lost little girls. Then one of them asks, in the smallest of voices, "What have you done?" Two of the girls hug each other. One of them, the only old woman among them, whispers into a dead phone. The others look around as if to wait for a command that never comes. "Anyone else want any trouble?" The girls shake their heads or study the ground, no threat to her. She lowers her bow and calls out for Coulter, tells him to come back. Then she settles her eyes on the girls and asks them where the rest of her friends are, and they point to the mall, and she says, "Show me." Chapter 40. For decades now, in the sanctuary's fourth ward, you didn't want to walk around at night unless you were looking for trouble, something to snort, someone to fuck or fight. Every morning, the first bell rang and the sun chased away the night and revealed the bodies of those beaten and stabbed, and the bodies of those who choked on their own puke, and the bodies of those who decided enough was enough and dove at a window or fell on a knife. In the heat, they bloated and festered, attracted rats and vultures, spread disease, so the sanctuary authorized a cleanup team. The Gatherers, they were called, mostly teenagers without a trade looking for some coin. When she was 13 years old, Clark joined them. Mornings, a donkey pulled a cart, and she hauled the bodies into it with an apron and elbow-length gloves and a bandana shielding her nose and mouth. She came to associate this color, the ashen color of early morning, with grief. Grief was a color. And that is the color of this place, North Dakota. And that is the color of her current state of mind. By the time Lewis finds her, she is already drunk. They have given her what she asked for, a drink, a real drink, a jar of moonshine derived from tree bark. She gulps from it, her thirst returned. This is on the roof of the mall, where her legs dangle over the edge, her body hunched over in the shape of a hook. Lewis approaches and touches her gently on the back.
"I was worried about you."
"Was?"
"Am."
"Yeah? You should worry about yourself."
She stiffens, and his hand falls off her.
"York?" he says.
She shakes her head and drinks and roughs a sleeve across her mouth. For a long minute, they stare off at the ice-humped city and the furnace glow of the oil fires beyond it. She drinks again from the jar. Her eyes waver in and out of focus.
"Hey, have you ever noticed something?"
She licks her lips as if her mouth has gone too dry for words.
"Have you ever noticed How my head is different shaped? How one side of my face looks different than the other? No, it's true. Look.
She turns her head one way, then the other, arranging her face into a scowl. Her breath is sour.
See? No. It's true. You've just got to look closer. One side is kind of pretty. You're not supposed to say that about yourself, but I'll say it, okay? I'll say it. I'm pretty. But not the other side. The other side, if you look at it on its own, is ugly.
She slaps a hand to her face in order to shade the one side of it. Maybe he can see it now. The drooping cheek, a broader ridge of forehead, the slight bulge of the eye, a little more lid around it.
I'm like two different people.
The wind gusts and carries bits of ice. She wobbles on her perch before catching her balance, spilling some of her drink.
You should come down from there.
Didn't I say worry about yourself? She looks at him with her red-rimmed eyes. In these long, wordless seconds, during which time they stare painfully at each other, he wants to tell her how sorry he is about her brother. He doesn't usually say things like that. Sorry, or thank you, or please, or any common pleasantry. It just doesn't occur to him. But he knows he ought to. Sorry might be the medicine she needs. He wants to tell her how much he admires her fearlessness and impulsiveness, how he has learned from her, grown into a better man by her example. He wants to tell her he not only worried about her last night, he missed her, too, as if he were a lizard dragged from the sun so that he felt enervated without her around, sour and cold-blooded. He wants to tell her that he needs her. They all do. He gathers his breath, but before he can blow out the word, she says, I'm a killer. I killed that woman outside. I killed my own brother. I killed Reed. I killed them all. I might kill you next. Who knows? This was my idea, coming here. It was a stupid, deadly idea, and we're all worse off for it. Stop it. Don't be so self-pitying. It doesn't become you. Do you know what I feel like right now? Her voice comes sliding out of her like sharpened steel.
I feel like eating you. Clark, I feel like eating the whole world, shoving all the metal and concrete and wood and bone and meat into my mouth until there is nothing left. You need to rest. You'll feel better once you rest.
I killed her, Lewis.
You did what you had to do. She was going to kill Coulter.
I don't mean her. It takes him a moment to process this.
Then who?
Her.
Her who?
Your mother, Lewis. I killed her so that you would come with us. The world seems to dim. The sky seems to sag. The wind rises and slaps his face. He waits for the anger to come. He knows it is there, inside him, waiting to catch flame. But for the moment, there is only a sick feeling, a green-tinged sadness. He opens his mouth, but no words will come.
Go away, Lewis, before I hurt you more than I already have.
When he makes no move to leave, she says, Go! In what sounds like a half howl. Now Lewis is running, pounding along as fast as he can, sliding, occasionally falling, but always scrambling to his feet. Always moving, away from the world he thought he knew and into the world he does not. Snow kicks up beneath his heels. Though the air is cold, his throat burns with exertion. The mall is behind him, like a great tomb, and he races away from it. He can feel the rage growing, growing, so that his inside feels bigger than his outside. And he is so hot, not just his breathing now, but his head, his skin, the core of him furnaced. He could tear off his clothes, eat snow. With this comes that familiar feeling of the sky opening up to watch him. He can sense it homing in on his dodging figure, and he knows he cannot escape it. Above him, the clouds begin to twirl as if spun with a spoon, and he hears the kind of crackling sound that comes from thick wool socks sliding across a rug. The parking lot reaches on endlessly. No matter how furiously he pumps his legs, the edge of it seems to grow no closer. He sees the vapor of his breath. He sees the ground thickly floored with ice. He sees the flicker of light gathering in the sky, where the clouds darken and churn and foment. as the anger spills out of him and takes hold of the world. The air around him seems to sparkle. He listens for thunder, but hears only the panicked gusting of his breath. He tries to run faster, but the lightning stops him mid-stride. It shoots from the sky and spears him, jags through his body like a second spine. Several more bolts join the first, like so many whips lashing at him, their barbs caught in his skin, filling him with painful light. He wakes, naked. His clothes are ashes curled away by the wind. His hair has scorched and brittle, and when he runs his hand across his belly, his eyebrow, his head, it crisps away. He is purely skin, his body as white and rigid as alabaster. He lies on his back, staring up at a night sky that looks like holes punched through black cloth, the biggest of them, the moon. The moon. How he has missed it, as shadowed and pale as a favorite grandfather's face. For a long time, this is all he sees, his vision absorbed by the sky, so that he might as well be floating through space. There is no sound except a distant ring, like the single, undying chime of a silver bell. He sits upright and takes in a world he recognizes, but not quite. Here is the parking lot, but it is crowded with cars. Here is the mall, but it is glowing with light. A woman in a red coat approaches, carrying shopping bags weighted with clothes. A man carries a girl on his shoulders. A couple walk arm in arm, laughing at a joke he cannot hear. The woman pauses to cough, and the cough overwhelms her, bending her over and spasming her body, and the man rubs her back to comfort her. The headlights on a truck flare beside him, and he stands in a hurry, spotlighted. The truck does not seem to see him, rolling from its spot, and he darts out of the way. He calls out to the woman in the red coat, but she does not look his way, digging into her purse and removing a silvery flash of keys. He grabs her then, presses his thumb deeply into the basin of her elbow, and though she frowns, she does not pause. He releases her as she pulls away. All around him, he now notices lights glow, a galaxy of light. Stoplights, street lamps, headlights, billboards, signage over stores and the windows beneath them. The starlit sky above cannot compare. Lewis wonders if he is caught in a dream, even as he knows he is not. He is perfectly awake and cannot escape or manipulate what surrounds him, slash a hand through it and make it ripple like water. Yet, like a dream, he goes along with whatever presents itself, in this case a black tunnel toward the edge of the parking lot, the only break he can find in this weird familiar world. A tunnel of trees, all the trunks leaning inward, arched and raftered with branches silvered with snow. He moves through its darkness, and the darkness moves through him. It is comforting, familiar, deep, timeless. He walks the passage, not cold, not at all, despite his bare feet padding the frosted ground. The sound grows louder, more painful, the farther he travels. Instead of a bell, it is now a knife in his ear. It warps and solidifies into a word. His name. A voice calls for him. Burrs. He does not want to go forward, but feels pulled there, as if down an inhaling throat. A branch scratches his arm, shadows shift among the trees, pacing him. At the end of the tunnel, a light awaits him. A light that brightens and blackens, like a great eye opening and closing. He fears the eye. It makes his breath come faster, and yet he can never seem to get enough, as if his chest is leaking, pierced. And then he is there, at the end, with the eye before him. Burning from the top of a lighthouse, with the great gray span of the ocean frothing and booming beyond it. Part 4. Whilst I viewed those mountains, I felt a secret pleasure in finding myself so near the head of the heretofore conceived boundless Missouri. But when I reflected on the difficulties which this snowy barrier would most probably throw in my way to the Pacific Ocean, and the sufferings and hardships of myself and the party in them, it in some measure counterbalanced the joy I had felt
in the first moments in which I gazed on them. But, as I have always held it little short of criminality to anticipate evils, I will allow it to be a good, comfortable road until I am compelled to believe otherwise. The Journals of Lewis and Clark. Chapter 41. Two women, sisters, the field sisters, old enough to thread their hair with gray, but how old exactly they don't know. They don't keep a calendar. They keep their hair short, a shaggy cut. Their faces and shoulders are broad. One of them has a mole on her upper lip, and the other doesn't. And one of them stands 6 feet tall, and the other a little less. But otherwise, they could be the same person. Maybe this is why they don't talk very often. What use are words when you can communicate with a narrow-eyed glance, a pointed finger, a pat on the back? They go still when asleep. Otherwise, they move quickly and efficiently, when digging clams, when robbing birds' nests of eggs, when cooking and eating, when mending clothes, when scavenging houses and stores. Right now, in a half-moon bay walled in by cliffs, one of them splits logs with a maul, while the other digs a wide, shallow crater in the sand. The axe chucks the wood that is piled into the crater and then set aflame. When it burns, they look to the sky, worried who might see the smoke, comforted by the long-hanging clouds. They stir the fire with a length of rebar, then rake it down to coals and let it cool, and collect the charcoal. They already have the rest of what they need. First, the potassium nitrate, deposits of bat guano they scraped from caves and attics. They soaked the gray mud of it in water for a day and then collected the crystals. And then the sulfur they salvaged from the cobwebbed shell of an ag store. They merge and screen and granulate the ingredients and fill up 10 10-gallon drums that weigh several hundred pounds each. The sisters manage to roll them and heft them into the back of a pickup truck that has been welded and patched with sheets of metal so many times that it appears like many vehicles clapped together. The bed sags with the weight. The tire's tubes are full of salt water. The engine runs poorly, but runs all the same, rebuilt to process biodiesel, the algae the sisters harvest. The key cranks, and the engine bellows and lopes and settles into a steady chug, punctuated by the occasional rattling pop. They keep it in first gear. The speedometer is broken, but their speed couldn't be more than 5 miles per hour. The pickup breaks down twice on the way to Young's Bay, and they spend an hour, then another hour, fixing it. One of them hunches over the engine block while the other surveys the road in either direction, with a rifle ready. The road is more an impression than a reality, a place where trees aren't. The asphalt has ground down to gravel. They drive around the occasional fallen limb and rock slide, but mostly the way is clear. The Warrenton-Astoria Highway reaches across the bay. It is passable, but crumbling in sections, the steel caging within visible, like bones peeking out of a melting snowdrift. The sisters park and unload the drums and roll them down the bridge and situate them at 10-foot intervals. They are made from a thick plastic that has aged gray. This matches the color of the bridge, camouflages the barrels, makes them appear like short pillars. Their fuses are made from fabric, glue, and oxidizing agents decanted from old weed killer. The sisters run a long web of them that wind together into one thick rope. They drive the pickup back down the road and next to a tumble-down building and throw clumps of moss on it along with a few sticks. Then they hike back to the bay, wearing backpacks and carrying rifles. They lead the thick coil of fuse into the woods and park themselves on a log with a clear view of the bridge. They unzip their backpacks and withdraw binoculars and oil and rags and books and dried fish and berries and nuts and canteens of water. They eat. They wait. Across the bay, the city of Astoria, a vast hive. Some 50,000 live there. Chimney smoke dirties the air. If it was night, its hills would glow with lamplight. 6 hours pass. Seagulls screech, waves lap, wind hushes. The rain comes steadily here, rarely pausing for more than an hour.
and the ocean breathes its salt into the air. Even the buttons on their jackets and jeans rust, so they take good care of their rifles, breaking them apart now to wipe down everything, the receiver, the barrel, the magazine, and then they dampen a rag with oil and wipe the parts down again and fit it all back together. They reload. They lever around. They set the safety. They lay the rifles beside them in easy reach. They read in shifts, one of them turning pages while the other peers through binoculars. Then, from across the bay, a caravan starts across the bridge. It is a long train of cows harnessed to empty wheeled cages. Metal clanks, hooves clop, leather and rope creak. Their approach will take a good 5 minutes. The sisters have paced out the fuse and calculated how quickly it will burn down. One of the sisters holds up a hand as if to say, "Steady, steady, steady," while the other readies her matches. Then the hand drops, chopping the air. One match sparks and dies in the wind, another splinters in half, the third one sputters out against the fuse, the fourth catches. A long, spitting snake works its way toward the bridge, sizzling its way through underbrush, around trees, across gravel, splitting up and following the 10 threads, rising into the barrels. The caravan is nearly upon them, and the sisters can see the man at the front of the column standing up in his carriage, pulling back on his reins. But it is too late. The sisters see the explosion before they hear it. An overlapping series of bright orange flashes surrounded by black roiling smoke run through with chunks of concrete and animal. The bridge drops and rises and expands all at once. The sound thumps the sisters, makes the trees around them shake and drop their leaves. The water in the bay dimples with the debris hailing down. The sisters remove their hands from their ears. They do not smile or raise their fists in celebration. They simply watch with composed but satisfied expressions as a burning man crawls a few paces and goes still, as smoke stains the air, as a 40-foot section of the bridge collapses into the bay and sends a wave rolling to the shore. Then they collect their things and zip their backpacks and shoulder their rifles and hold hands when they hike back to their pickup. Chapter 42. Lewis marches steadily west through a world laced and spired with ice. The wind never stops, and the snow lashes his eyes and scrapes them red. He lost his hair to the lightning. It grew back as white and bristled as the hoarfrost along the riverbanks. When he first left the sanctuary, he wondered more than once what the hell he was doing. He buried that question long ago, but it has been replaced by another. How the hell is he going to do it? If he is to survive, if he is to traverse this unforgiving place and avoid threats, human and animal and elemental, if he is to arrive in a wondrous American landscape, a new Eden, he will be more than a long way geographically from his old self in St. Louis. He will be a new person entirely. This drives him through the snow. The green promise of a better place, the whispered promise of a better self in the voice of Aaron Burr. Lewis wishes he could simply sweep a hand and knock 100 pounds of snow this way, another 100 pounds that way, as if he were the wind itself. But whatever powers he possesses are limited, accidental, uncontrolled, as if he were a toddler finding his legs or forming his mouth around a word for the first time. He does not understand what he can do, only yearn and puzzle over whatever happy accidents he produces. Coulter and Joea hike beside him. They wear snowshoes. Their pants stiffen and fringe white, and beneath them their legs feel separate, leaden and thudding with every step, so that sometimes they feel they are clopping along on their hip bones. They do not complain. They do not speak at all. As far as he can remember, the last time he said anything might have been back in Bismarck, when he told the doctor to rest, and once rested, to watch after Clark. "She's not well. She's going to need you." He kneeled next to the doctor's cot. She had lost a lot of blood,
grown anemic, but she had stubbornly risen back to health, just as Lewis had risen from the smoldering crater in the parking lot, weakened but determined. The silver hair spiraled around her head like roots without purchase. She fumbled for his hand and found it and squeezed it. Her voice came out as if through a filter of sand.
I wasn't so sure before, but I'm certain of it now. You're the best of men.
Most would call me horrible, I think.
It's the world that's horrible. But you'll finish what we started?
Yes. She ran a thumb along the ridgeline of his knuckles, as if imagining the landscape he must yet navigate.
You're carrying everyone's dreams with you.
Lewis was never one to smile, but he smiled for her then.
We'll see each other down the trail.
We will, indeed.
That seems so long ago. What must be weeks, though he can't be sure, having lost track of time. That is easy to do when everything seems the same. The sky is gray-ceilinged, absent of sun and moon and stars, lit by the oil fires that make the air taste like ashes, that make him cough up black slugs every morning. Sometimes, when he is trudging along, he believes he sees others around him. He believes he is walking with the dead. His mother wisps in and out of sight. Reed coughs up bullets. His horse, rotted down entirely to bone, gallops along with a clatter. A decapitated York juggles three of his heads. And not just them, but others, too. The shades of people driving roads and walking sidewalks and hanging laundry, as if history were a nightmare he can't escape. Their footsteps match his, so that he feels like he is traveling with them, for all of them. This is not the first time this reach of country has been void of human life. Everything rises and falls, everything cycles, and maybe he will play some small role in the next rotation. He hopes so. How else can he justify pressing on, except by imagining himself a seed in the wind, a hero in a song? They would be lost, if not for the river, which grows narrower by the day as they approach its headwaters. Now and then something distinguishes the featureless landscape. A windbreak of trees next to a farm, a cluster of bushes or bunches of wild grass that, frosted with ice, look like white antlers breaking from the ground. A town where they find a house to hunker down, escape the wind. It is a squat brick home, the gutters wearing glassy fangs of ice. Joea stomps on a wooden chair to make kindling. Coulter shudders with the cold that possesses him. His skin flares pink with white spots. His fingers might be made of wood, stiff and curled, and he shoves them in his armpit to heat. There was a time when Lewis always felt cold, but now, even when surrounded by snow, he feels warm, as if he carries a torch inside him. He can start a fire with his hands. He grips the wood until it combusts. The process feels a little like blowing out a hard breath until your chest hitches and your lungs have nearly collapsed. This is the only time he feels chilled, when the energy he expels leaves him temporarily empty, husked. He owns fire, but fire owns him. They share a dangerous dominion. Coulter holds out his hand to the fire, trying to warm it, and then just as quickly uses it to shield his face as a dark cluster of bats escapes the chimney and fills the room in a twittering rush before breaking apart, escaping to the far corners of the house. Joea kicks apart another chair and adds it to the fire, then drags in some wood from outside and adds it too, and before long, the chimney is whistling from the draw. Several bricks fall on the flames and knock embers on the floor. The blankets crack like glass when Coulter stomps on them and lays them by the fire to thaw, and they give off wisps of vapor.
Where are we again?
Coulter says.
Still in North Dakota, Joea says.
I wouldn't wish North Dakota on anyone.
In the kitchen, Lewis digs through the cupboards and pulls out a dried bundle of noodles, as brittle as straw. He fills a pot with snow to melt. He looks out the window and sees, still hanging from a pole, the tatters of an American flag. Nothing but barely colored threads. At night,
They are a small cave of light in the never-ending darkness. That is when the noises begin. In uneven waves, the wind howls and moans and mutters the nightmare sounds of a zoo on fire. Joea sleeps without any seeming trouble, but Coulter wraps a blanket around his head to muffle the sound. Lewis tries to sleep, but cannot. The night shrieks, it pleads, and threatens, and whines. When he does dream, he dreams of terror. Clark waits for him outside, her face transformed into a wolf's. A lighthouse flares and profiles the figure of Burr standing before it. A lump swells painfully along Lewis's ribcage. He lances it open and finds an eyeball blinking redly at him. He is awake long before dawn. He watches the fires pluming out in the darkness. He misses the stars he hasn't seen in such a long time. They remain hidden, along with the moon, the sun, behind the suffocating mantle of clouds. He thinks of them now, thinks about how, just out of sight, all that light is streaming down, light that has traveled millions of years, billions of miles. For what? For nothing. All that time and distance sponged away. He worries that is what is happening to them, to the group of people that set out from the sanctuary, all the energy that made them press across what felt like an interminable nothing, now dissipating, in danger of being lost altogether. He kneels by the fireplace and unsleeves his journal from the oilcloth that surrounds it. It feels warm in his hands, as if blood courses through it. He fingers through its pages with a birdwing flutter. Here is a song York sang around a campfire. Here is a mixture of several herbs the doctor told him would heal an infection. Here is a sketch of the river alleying through the woods, and another of a mutated squirrel, and another of an unusually large and spotted egg, something waiting to be born. And another of Clark atop her horse, profiled against the sun. He has left her behind, but in a way, he feels he still follows her. He closes the journal with a sense of loss and longing. They travel farther and farther still, into eastern Montana, where the oil fires cease and the snow thins and gives way to browned grass and sagebrush. In the distance rises the massive spine of the mountains. Their footsteps cut across the grass, the frozen ground, with a shredding sound. "What were you thinking, Coulter?" Lewis says.
"You mean when I was running naked across that field of ice from a group of mad women who wanted to stick me full of arrows?"
"I actually meant, why did you come with me?"
"What was the alternative? Stay behind in the iciest asshole of the world? Besides, you're such good company. I don't know what I'd do without you."
Lewis stops. "Really? I want to know."
"Oh, we're getting all shitty and serious, are we?"
Coulter pulls down his scarf and reveals his scarred face. He studies Lewis a long time before saying,
"I said before, I thought of your father as if he were my own father. I meant that. I guess that makes you a kind of brother. However you want to think about it, we're in common cause. We're both serving something bigger. That's what I used to think about the sanctuary. That's what I think now. You feel the same, don't you?"
"I do." Lewis trudges forward again, and Coulter matches his pace. "I wouldn't be able to do it without you."
"Not gonna argue with you on that one."
They are so thin, the veins stand out from their skin like wires. They kill pheasant, grouse, possum, rabbits, rats, sheep, coyote, deer, antelope, some mutated and some with cancers, blooming like mushrooms inside them. Though Lewis has no appetite, every nerve in his body frayed by exhaustion, he forces himself to eat. Coulter believes they are being followed. It is hard to tell with the wind searing and his eyes welling with tears and blown snow obscuring the air. In a bare passage of land, nothing but bunch grass, they walk for several miles, making sure there is nothing around they might mistake for a person. And then they spin around. Nothing.
"I swear," Coulter says. "The hair on the back of my neck swears."
Lewis knows whom it is Coulter senses.
The same man he feels tugging them forward. The man in white, Aaron Burr. In Lewis's dreams, he dropped a stone, and the stone fell, and then the stone rose. The stone flew from the ground and snapped into his palm, caged by his fingers, as if he possessed his own gravity. That is how Burr feels to Lewis, gravitational. There was a time in his life when he saw his father everywhere, on a stage before a crowd of people, in a painting in a hallway, at the head of a long table, and even when he didn't see him, he thought of him, anticipating his command or disapproval.
Straighten your posture this, and get your head out of a book that.
And now, no matter how hard he tries, he cannot remember his father's face. It has been replaced by Burr's. He sees him in the snow, and in the clouds, and in any mirrored surface. Burr visits him when he sleeps. He holds out a hand, beckoning him, and Lewis feels a pull. He feels as the stone must. "We're being watched," Lewis says. "But there's no one there." Every day he asks Joea to tell him more about Oregon, about Burr, but she no longer wishes to talk. "Just wait and see," she says, or, "It won't be long now," or sometimes she says nothing at all. He tries not to feel bothered by this. York's death did something to her. She has regressed, grown guarded and reserved again, as if contained by her own personal wall, not wanting to let anyone get close. Sometimes her eyes look like black puddles that, with a blink, will go streaming down her cheeks. He hopes time will heal her, bring back the girl they were just getting to know. Chapter 43. Slade is tired of clearing paths through the whores and beggars on the streets, shoving aside those bone-thin and swollen-bellied and bent-kneed rabble who ask him for money, for food, for water, for a fuck that might come with a favor. He is tired of people speaking to him with voices that range only between pleading and accusatory. He is tired of the blinding sun. He is tired. So he goes where no one can bother him, to his windowless basement room, where the shadows are as deep and cooling as water, where he keeps company with his dummies. He walks among them, the mannequins with cracked faces and glued-on hair and torn fingernails, and the patchwork ensemble he gathered gradually for all of them. One was Jillian, a baker's daughter, whose hair smelled like flour and whose breasts reminded him of mounds of dough. Another was Becca, the sister of one of his deputies, who liked to whistle when she walked, like a little bird, beckoning him. And Manda, and Ankeny, and now Ella, so fierce, his favorite so far. His ears still buzz with the noise of the city, his mind still aches with the brightness of the day, but if he closes his eyes and stands as still as his dummies and breathes deeply through his mouth, he feels like he is drinking in peace, filling himself with a cool, blue calm. Every day he enlists more deputies, but he has no illusions about their loyalty. They are devoted only to the food and water that come with the job. And though a man with a weapon and a uniform is worth five without, his police force is outnumbered many times over. The sanctuary could be overtaken, if only people weren't so afraid. He must keep them that way, as a manager and profiteer of terror. The other day, when he was walking without an escort through the Fourth Ward, a collection of deteriorating buildings full of cutthroats, gamblers, whores, someone hurled a bag of filth at him. It exploded against his chest and then plopped to the ground. He stood there a moment, incredulously wiping his hands through the oozing smear, before looking around and noticing the streets crammed with crook-mouthed, thin-eyed people who studied him with a collective ferocity that made him feel, for the first time in his life, small. He hurried away, knowing that they might be seconds away from swarming him. For all his administration, Thomas has relied on the enemy beyond the walls. But he must worry now about the enemy within them. If Thomas knew about Ella, she would be dead. And if Ella were anyone else, Slade would have killed her himself. But so many months ago,
When he first questioned her in the museum, he immediately noted her as a favorite, like a special passage earmarked in a book. It was a feeling he knew well, the same spark of recognition he experienced around Jillian and Becca and Manda and Ankeny, his gallery of favorites. He can harm her. He can harm anyone. He has the power to accuse strangers, beat them senseless, cuff them and noose them, with nothing in the way of consequence except more hatred directed his way. He is omnipotent, and omnipotence comes with boredom. That is why the Greek gods used to assume human form, to play with stakes that at least felt more real. He likes to play. He likes reducing himself to a kind of suitor. Of course, she knew something about Lewis departing the sanctuary. Of course, he would communicate with her by owl. Of course, she was responsible for the rabble-rousing graffiti. That was one of the reasons she was a favorite. Because she wasn't a common fool, like so many others, but a worthy adversary, a mind sprung with claws, which made it his job to tame her, cow her. He follows her sometimes, through the sun-soaked streets, the cluttered aisles of the bazaar, not because he believes he will learn anything professionally valuable, but simply to make a study of her. He likes the way she marches instead of walks, always square-shouldered. He likes the way she bargains with people, pointing a finger and setting her mouth. And the way she touches whatever interests her, a carved door, an overripe melon, a one-armed doll, lets her finger linger, as if to taste. This morning, after she collected her daily ration of water, he followed her back to the museum, trailing her like a shadow. She sensed him only when she keyed open the door, and by then it was too late. She turned in time to see him shove her inside. Her jug fell, and the cap spun off, and the water glug-glug-glugged across the floor, and for a moment, that was the only sound besides their breathing. As he rammed her up against the wall with a palm cupping her shoulder, a thumb horning her clavicle. Then he said, in a calm, quiet voice that hardly paused between words, "You stupid girl, you stupid, stupid girl, you think I don't know about what you've been up to? You think you can go on pretending you're not part of what's happening? Let me tell you something. Let me give you a little lesson. Some believe love is the most powerful of all emotions, but that's just a nice lie people tell themselves. Terror wins. Terror beats love any day. No emotion can control a crowd, can imprint itself so fully onto the human mind. You run this museum, so you know all about this, don't you? You know about how this country, if you can call it that, a country, has been held hostage by terrorism? The bombings of Pearl Harbor, the assassination of JFK, the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Yes, I know a thing or two. I'm not as mindless as some people think. Those stories of long ago and far away might not seem real, but they happened. And when they happened, they owned everyone. They paralyzed everyone by the millions. That's what terror can do. That's what I can do to you and to this city." He let her go then and stepped back, and the last of her water hiccuped from the jug. She rubbed her chest where his arm had been. "You're a no-good bully, and you're wrong." He laughed then. He couldn't help himself. He outweighed her by more than 100 pounds. He could crush her like a cockroach. But she would not flinch. She had such fight to her.
"Oh, do tell. How am I wrong?"
"It's like this. Terror might make someone kill, but love will make someone die. People die for love. They would give up anything for love, even their life. And don't you see? That's a denial of the most basic of all human instincts, survival." Her eyes wander away from his and seem to zero in on something. But when he turns, there is only an empty doorway.
"What were you looking at?"
"Get out of here," she says. "Leave me alone." She tries to push past him. He slaps her and forces her to the floor with an elbow to the throat, and she burbles like a toad at the pressure.
"No,"
she says, but seems again to be looking behind him.
"Don't!"
From his pocket, he removes a pair of pliers. He fingers open her mouth and shoves the pliers inside and says,
Steady now.
With a wrenching crack, he removes one of her molars. He holds up the red-rooted tooth as he departs her.
That's for what you wrote on the wall, and all the trouble it's caused me. The next time you do something stupid, I'll come back for the rest of you.
Now, in the basement, in the dark, he holds the molar in his palm. He pops it in his mouth and sucks on it and tongues its grooves and tastes her sour blood. Then he spits it out and dries it on his shirt and retrieves a pot of glue and patiently holds it to the mouth of her dummy as if suffocating it. When he lets his hand fall, the tooth remains, jeweled to the face of the thing. Chapter 44. The mountains grow nearer, gradually dominating the horizon, their peaks cutting into the clouds. In their foothills, the snow begins again, whiter now than before. They rest in Billings for several days, and again in Bozeman. Here the downtown is surrounded by a defensive perimeter made from logs with sharpened points. It has been burned and breached. Blackened wood and blackened bones rise out of the snow. The smell of smoke still lingers in the air. The people here have been dead weeks, maybe months.
"Who did this?" Lewis says.
He kneels beside a skull small enough to fit into his hand. A child's.
"What happened here?" "Are you sure we should be going this way?"
Coulter says. Joea shakes her head. Maybe she doesn't know, or maybe she doesn't care, or maybe she doesn't want to tell. Not so long ago, Lewis believed in the end of the rainbow. A shire, an emerald city, Elysian fields. What his childhood storybooks promised. He believed, back when they first set out from the sanctuary, that something Arcadian awaited them. Not anymore. Not now. Not when he sees the bone-riddled ruins of Bozeman. It is not only the landscape that disappoints, it is humankind. Inside and outside the wall, humans remain the same, capable of wonderful things, yes, but more often excelling in ruin. And Burr is human. He cups a handful of snow over the skull and stands and wipes his hands off. "Is there something you need to tell me, Joea?"
"No,"
she says, and keeps her head down and continues hiking forward. At the edge of town, they enter a pole shed with rust trails weeping from the every bolt. Inside, they find a sign, Bozeman Foundry, hanging above a desk with a pile of paper squared on it. Lewis picks up a work order for 2 dozen horseshoes, a sharpened saw, a repaired scythe. There is some dust, but not a lot, that he runs a finger through. This was a working site, a working community, home to however many thousands. Joea shrugs off her pack and lies on the floor and shoves her fists against her eyes. Coulter says, "You all right?" And when she doesn't respond, he begins opening and closing drawers, closets, cupboards, not knowing what he might find, something of use, while Lewis walks through the entry office and into the cavernous workspace. His boots crunch over metal shavings. Hammers and clamps and files hang from the wall. He wanders past forges, stacks of casings and molds, an induction furnace and an electric arc furnace, a small hill of firewood. The air is dirty with the scorched nut smell of molten metal. His foot clatters a ladle lying on the floor, and the noise brings Coulter out of the office. He's gnawing on something and holds out a handful of it.
"Found a stash of jerky. Not bad."
Lewis tours the equipment and then settles his gaze on Coulter.
"What?"
"I'm sorry I doubted you."
"Only a fool wouldn't have doubted me."
"I want to do something for you." They spend the rest of the day burning wood, pumping bellows, stirring coals, scraping designs into sand castings. They melt scrap metals and refine the alloy and pour it into the molds and let it cool before tumbling the component from it. They sweat. Their skin blackens with soot. They wield tongs and sledgehammers and scythe hammers and embossing hammers that chirp against the heated metal set upon the bullhorn anvil. Red and yellow sparks fall around their feet. They grind and sand and polish. They fit together hinges,
tighten bolts, oil gears, and when they finally finish, Coulter slides the stump of his arm into the prosthetic, and Lewis tightens the leather straps around his shoulders and buckles them. In place of bones, there are fitted pipes, and in place of a hand, three barbed fingers that open into a claw and close into a fist. He experiments with it, bending his elbow, extending his arm for a slash.
They used to call me the Black Fist, you know?
I know. Lewis crumples onto a stool and wipes the soot from his face with a rag. What do you think? Coulter bends over and picks up a cinder block. His claw crushes it, and a spray of gravel dusts the air and dirties the floor.
I think it will do quite nicely.
Joya presses her fists against her eyes and pushes until colors violet and rose, red and dandelion yellow explode against the lids. They remind her of flowers, fields of flowers that she might dive into, roll around in, tangled in their stalks, bombed by their perfume. It's so much easier to dream in color than to open her eyes to the gray nothing of the world. She should have known better. She shouldn't have let herself get close to them. But York wouldn't leave her alone, his face always dodging into her field of vision, his hands always touching her on the shoulder, the waist, the cheek. That day she swiped the trout from his plate and shoved it in her mouth. It was only the beginning of the tastes shared between them. Now he is gone, just like her parents, like her Oma, everyone close to her, punished and then killed, so that living feels like a rehearsal for dying. She was just so lonely and felt antidoted by his company, warmed by his touch. She was sent to retrieve Lewis, not Clark, not Reed, and not the doctor, and not Coulter, not York, just Lewis. But she had no choice. They came as a group. She planned to deliver Lewis, as promised, and then Burr would give her what she requested. Whatever happened to the rest of them, she did not care. Initially, if they got in her way, she might have killed them herself. They were irrelevant to her. That's what she told herself. That's why she maintained such a cool distance until she couldn't anymore. They became relevant to her, more than names, but people, friends. The hard part was supposed to be the journey, the unforgiving temperatures, the cruel landscape, the scarcity of food and water. But it is the mental assault that has been unendurable. Maybe this mission means nothing. On the one side, Burr is a false prophet. On the other side, Lewis strives for irrelevance. There is no human endeavor. No matter how much people clung to family, breeding more children, and to community, building more houses and businesses and roads to bind them, everyone dies alone. Whether from sickness or injury or old age, you die alone. And there is nothing bad or good about death, just as there is nothing redemptive or admirable about being human. It doesn't matter how powerful you are, or how far you travel, or how many books you read, or where you live. That's all one big distraction from the open grave waiting to swallow you in the end. There is no escape for humankind, and there is no escape for her, and none for Lewis, either. But despite all these feelings thrashing inside her, she has continued to put one foot in front of the other, leading them toward Oregon. Trees don't love and they don't mourn, but they strive for sun and for water. They live. That is the one true impulse, she supposes, that everything wants to live. Something waits for her in Oregon that is the equivalent of sun and water. A promise. Burr promised her. Lewis trusts her. He handed over his life to her. He follows her still, as if they are corded together. He follows her through pillaged and burned communities, and the best answer she can give him when he asks what happened is, I don't know. Though she does. The same thing that happened to these villages happened to hers. How can she ignore that? She is betraying herself as much as betraying Lewis. But she guides him, and he follows her, and she follows the river, and in Three Forks, the river finally dies, a gray wash of seep that they give wide berth, not wanting to get stuck in the slush. They follow the remains of the freeway for 3 days before the mountains rise severely before them. Slabs of stone, like altars and pillars, peek out of the snow with lichen stitched across them like the cipher of some dead race.